All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a hell of a show for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll hear an interview I did with Sonia Kennebec, director and producer of National Bird. Now, National Bird is a scathing exposure of what U.S. imperialism's drone program does to people all around the world. And it involves people who were actually in the drone program coming forward to testify about the horrors that were unleashed on the world by the U.S. using these drones. And I have to say, folks, this is one more example of the murderous and barbaric practices institutionalized under Obama that will now be handed over to the fascist Donald Trump. Yeah, what a great world, eh? And right now, get ready for a special segment with Andy Z and PZ Myers. It's going to be bringing you information about knowledge of a whole new thing that's coming into the society that's actually absolutely essential for the society. It's a huge, huge event. It's an event that actually is, it's a month long. I'll tell you what, it's like a month-long uprising all over the country aimed at millions and millions and millions of people coming out and creating a situation whereby Donald Trump, the fascist, is not able to get inaugurated. He's not able to actually do that, that they're not able to put this monster into power. And it's going to depend on you, on the people. That's what it's going to depend on, people getting behind us. So joining us today to talk about this is Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and he's one of the initiators of the Refuse Fascism Statement. And he's joined by PZ Myers, biologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota Morris, author of the blog Feringula, author of The Happy Atheist, and one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism as well. And he's also was for a while and will be again in the future a regular visitor to this show. And I'm really pleased to welcome them both to the show. Andy, PZ, welcome.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Long time since
Hi, Michael. How are you? Hi, PZ.
Okay, so we're going to jump into this. I don't want to spend a lot of time messing around. I want to actually just get to the point of what's going on with this and what's so important about this. So I want to maybe start off with Andy. I'll start off asking you, why don't you give people, one, an overview of what this is, this no, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. This campaign, what is it and where did it come from?
Okay, well, this, as you say, that's the title of a call for a month of resistance. No, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. And this is an initiative that's been begun just in over the last week or so, pulling together people as many as we can, as soon as we can, to recognize, on the basis of recognizing how many millions and millions of people are deeply, deeply upset about this situation with the election of Trump. And they're upset is because this really is, if you look at the breadth of his program and the administration that he's assembling, is nothing other than a fascist regime, a regime that will strip away the rights of people in so many arenas and possibly destroy the planet, let alone, as others have said, threaten the lives of millions of people. And in coming to grips with this, we have recognized that it has to be stopped before it starts. And that if it's not, it is but an illusion to think we can wait this out. Now is the time to act. And so we've come up with a plan that we are gathering signatures on people to initiate this. And then, indeed, even more people are signing the call for it. But the essence of it is this, if I can just read from the plan that we've put forward. We say that people should imagine that if masses of people in their tens of millions fill the streets and powerfully declare that this regime is illegitimate and demand that it not be allowed to rule, think about that. Then it goes on to say the whole political landscape would be dramatically transformed. Every faction within the established power structure would be forced to respond. And all this could well lead to a situation in which this fascist regime is actually prevented from ruling. This is not some idle dream, but something which could be made a reality if all those who hate what is represented by this fascist regime translate their outrage into firm determination and massive mobilization to create the conditions which make this possible. So that's the essential purpose and message, and then we can talk about the why and also, most important, the plan to make this real, including that we're really kicking this off on Monday the 19th with an emergency mass organizing meeting in New York City at Cooper Union to be followed by meetings all around the country. And this will be live streamed on the internet, the meeting in New York, but then similar meetings happening everywhere.
Now, PZ, you're also one of the initiators. Why did you feel so compelled to be part of this?
Oh, that's easy. We've elected a corrupt demagogue, and we have to do something. I like the idea of a month's resistance because the alternative is 4 years of resistance or a decade of resistance or a century of resistance if we last that long. So I think this is the time that we need to stand up and fight back to resist as much as possible before the horrible things happen. I mean, we're just looking at the people he's nominating to various positions right now, and it's clear he's bringing in incompetence and ideologues and theocrats and just generally horrible people. But even if we get rid of Trump, if we don't get rid of them too, we're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you guys talk about this, when you say that the Trump regime, Andy, you were mentioning this, that the Trump regime is illegitimate, let's talk about, because a lot of people say, yeah, that's true, but really get into why. What makes it so?
Well, PZ just touched on that. Look at the program. Look at what they've actually proposed to do. This is the most fundamental thing. This is, its fascist character is what renders it not only illegitimate, but immoral and against the interests of all of humanity. And there comes a time when people have to recognize that. I mean, there are things that basic principles of justice, of the separation of church and state. Look, he's proposed for people who dissent either through protest and burn an American flag, a symbol of the U.S., or people who incorporate into a work of art in ways that determined by him and his administration are unpatriotic, that not only should that be criminalized, but that people should be locked in jail and deprived of citizenship, stateless people, at the same time that he says he's going to not only keep Guantanamo open, but fill it. So people have to understand this is extremely serious. He's talking about deporting 1.5 to 2 million, maybe 3 million people off the bat, forming registers of people on the basis of their faith. This is serious stuff, and as PZ just brought out, he's assembled a motley crew of, no offense to the band here, but he's assembled a really gallery of rogues, as we've called it, of people who are theocrats. They are misogynists, some of them actual sexual predators, racists, xenophobes. These are a very dangerous group of people, and every one of them has a track record that backs this up. And so we have to understand they get hold of the mechanisms of state, and it's going to be a drastic change, including because they do face massive opposition from the people. So what they're going to have to do to institute this program is not going to be anything that we want to wait and see how they do.
Well, let's talk about it a little bit more, because one of the things I was thinking was, you know, when you talk about this, about the threat of fascism, as PZ was mentioning, as the literature around the campaign gets into, this threat of fascism, that it's real now. It's real, not as opposed to something that has happened throughout U.S. history, some of the other, you know, more sort of severe regimes or the regimes that were really, you know, could be counted out as like, well, these were really, you know, butchers to one degree or another. This is actually a leap to a fascist regime. And I thought that that was actually one of the things that really, that actual leap to fascism was actually one of the things that determines in a certain sense or has a lot to influence around the question of whether or not the whole regime is illegitimate, not any one aspect of it, but the whole regime and this leap to fascism is fairly key here, I think.
Yeah, because, you know, one of the things that's happening here is the way the country is run is not simply by literal sets of laws. There are also customs and traditions and precedents that are essential for holding together the fabric of government. And what Trump has done is, you know, you could say, yes, he has got a majority of the Electoral College so far voting for him, so he will be president. But at the same time, you have to say that, you know, well, but presidents are supposed to be, you know, for the people. They're supposed to be servants to the people. They are supposed to be perpetuating the institutions that we already have in government, like, for instance, the EPA, the Energy Commission, and so forth. And he's made it very clear right from the very beginning that his goal is to destroy those institutions. You know, for instance, he's brought in a person to run the education who opposes public education and thinks it needs to be demolished and replaced with a more Christian, Jesus-y sort of principle for teaching kids. that's simply defying all tradition, all precedent, making a total mess of what is supposed to be an institution that helps the education in this country.
Mm-hmm. Andy, you have any comments on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is, I agree with PC. Actually, the beginning of what he said was a little garbled on my phone, so I didn't hear it, but the part on education I did hear. Look, every single arena, this is a rupture from what have been cohering norms in various arenas of society and questions of ethos and things like this. This is a real break. And it is one that has been decades in the making. I mean, yes, in one sense, you can very much trace it to foundational issues in America and the genocide of the Native American people and slavery. But over the last several decades, there has been the development of a really Christian fascist fundamentalist movement in this country that, with many different factions to it, and it's cohered with different parts of other very reactionary movements that particularly unified around white supremacy and misogyny as cohering, you know, the white nation kind of deal. But now Trump has managed to give voice and now vehicle of the state power to all of this. And that is what makes it a qualitative change. In our call that we are soliciting signatures and donations for to be able to publish everywhere, it says, after enumerating all these aspects of the Trump-Pence agenda, is that this is fascism. It's serious. It has direction and momentum. It fascism foments and it relies on xenophobic nationalism, racism, misogyny, and aggressive reinstitution of oppressive traditional values. It feeds on, encourages the threatened use of violence to build a movement and come to power. Once in power, it essentially eliminates traditional democratic rights, very much to the point that Pizzi just made on the right to a public education. Fascism attacks, jails, and even executes its opponents and launches violent mob attacks on minorities. And in Germany in the 30s and 40s, fascism did all these things. This is where it can go. And yes, Hitler himself could talk graciously when he felt it would serve his interest to lull his opponents. So I think this is what that people have to see, and it's people have used the analogy to if you put some frogs in cold water and turn up the heat, they will just sit still till the boiling point. And we can't wait. You can't wait out fascism. You can't work with the fascists where you find agreement with them. First off, you shouldn't, but even if you could, such as when the president of the AIA, the American Institute of Architects, we talked about this before, Michael, you know, said, well, we're willing to work on you where we can cooperate. Well, would you design the internment camps for the Japanese? Would you build the prisons on the border? Or would you build the railroad to Dachau? These are the kinds of questions that have to be posed very sharply, and right now, people should not accommodate, conciliate, collaborate. And this is why we're saying it's fascism. And exactly a case in point is education, which PZ just nailed. This goes against what people have come to expect.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Z, who is the spokesperson for the New York City Revolution Books, and he's also one of the initiators of RefuseFascism.org, and P.Z. Myers, biologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota, Morris, and the author of the blog Faringo. He's also one of the other initiators of Refuse Fascism, and the whole event that's been called No, in the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept the Fascist America, and that event is calling for a month of resistance beginning on December 19th, reaching a crescendo by January 20th, 2017 inauguration. Right before we get into, I know you're really chomping at the bit to talk about what the plans are and stuff, but I wanted to ask a couple more questions because there's also some things that I've been reading where in sort of countercurrents that are out there, and it's not directly, it's not in response to this, but it's actually, there's these countercurrents among the people that are out there and a lot of, sometimes very progressive people who are arguing, well, we can rely on checks and balances. We really don't have to worry. We can rely on making him a one-term president. We can do, you know, all these kinds of things that they might look at in another time and say, you could say, well, okay, what whether you think they'd work or they won't work or they're useless or not, you could say, okay, there's something different here now, though, something very different. A situation like this has not existed in this country before, I don't think. So let's talk about that a little bit, this thing of people's sort of looking for ways short of this or stating that, you know, really pushing out ways short of it. Like one guy, one constitutional rights lawyer said, I can't remember what piece, but he said, well, I'm not that worried because, after all, I will be in the courts taking him on each time he violates the Constitution. You know, so let's talk about what these other solutions, and then we'll get into the solution that you're talking about.
Yeah, we've been hearing this throughout the election. First we heard there's no way he can get elected. And I thought that was true too. And then we heard, well, he's been elected, but he won't be as bad as he said he would be. And what we're seeing in the recent appointments is that he's going to be worse than he ever promised to be. So it's definitely past time that we stopped deluding ourselves and started taking this guy seriously. And taking him seriously means recognizing that, yes, he is an incipient fascist who's going to be doing horrible things to the country, and we have to do something now to stop him.
Andy?
Yeah, I really agree with that. You know, you've got to actually look at the essence of his illegitimacy is the program that he will implement, and he's shown he's got the people who want to do it, and he's got a mass movement. I mean, they were just, I think it was in Michigan the other day, you had the whole crowd chanting, lock her up. They're still talking about jailing Hillary Clinton. And not that I'm a supporter of Hillary Clinton, but you get a sense when they're willing to actually jail and threaten to actually assassinate a leader of the other major party, then you know this is serious stuff. And, you know, talking about 2018 at this point or 2020, when you have a party that, first off, they closed hundreds of polling places across the country through ripping up a lot of the Voting Rights Act. They've redistricted, and give you one sense about how serious these people are. In an election they actually contested but then lost in North Carolina, they've basically, in the last couple of days, the legislature in North Carolina have basically reduced the governorship to a ceremonial position. These people will not make it possible for you to have any kind of semblance of having any say-so in 2018. Plus, they're going to pack the Supreme Court. So our lawyer friends have got to understand that, and they're going to pack every other court because there's a tremendous number of vacancies, because these people have been serious about one thing. They have been driven to develop, they have a different idea of what this country should be. And while I, in my own opinion, have a spokesperson of Revolution Books, an opinion on this country, a very strong opinion that it's past its time and we can do something far better. But right now we have to take a very sharp look at that these people are going to, and this regime will rip up the norms, the political norms, the social norms, the cultural norms of this society. They're going to start. Yes, they'll run into some obstacles, but they will steamroll through that. This is a serious thing. And so in that sense, I completely agree with TZ. People have to cast away the illusions. That said, I think if we put forward a bold plan that could actually derail this, then that can involve many of those people to take part in this thing, even as they may hold on to, and most of them probably will hold on to, various illusions that they can do things if he does take power. But I think we can inspire them to give this a shot. And I think we do have to wage struggle with people who stand in the way of this, but I think we should actually involve a lot of these people who maybe hold out that it would not be as bad as they think, to get out in the streets now and stop it before it starts. And the more they get out there, I think the more they will see the veracity, the truth of what we are actually putting forward as the only way to really stop this and to prevent it. And yes, what we're proposing, look, is hard. It's never been done. It's a long shot. We know that. But the one thing that is sure, that if we don't do this, it's going to be really, really bad. And that's not going to be a future that anybody should be passive in the face of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I would also add that one of our problems is that basically the Democratic Party and the media are colluding with this. Not openly saying, yeah, we're all in favor of this. They're instead saying, you know, we have to get along with these people. We have to work with them. We have to support him because he is our president. And yet, at the same time, the other side is happily, as Andy says, tearing up all the norms and just throwing everything out the window and show no signs of limiting their actions. So it's kind of, we've got the ineffectual party against the theocratic fascist party. And we've got to get some spine into the people who need to oppose these guys.
I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with P.Z. Myers, Assistant Professor of Biology at the University of Minnesota Morris and author of the blog Pharyngula, and Andy Z., spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City. And P.Z. and Andy are two of the initiators of No, In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept the Fascist America. This interview was recorded earlier, and the event that they will talk about later on December 19th has already happened. But you can watch the Facebook video of that event by going to refusefascism.org. So once more, that's refusefascism.org, and you can watch the whole event that Andy and PZ are talking about. And I really recommend you do that. Which brings us back to the No, In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept the Fascist America campaign, where it's being argued that the time now is the time for nationwide upheaval to create the kind of situation that would actually stop this, as Andy was saying and you were saying earlier. Let's talk about that. What are the plans in this campaign?
Well, people can go to the website, refusefascism.org, and see the actual plan. That's now we're in the process of fleshing it out. We're discussing things. But the essence of the plan is to get in a position that by the middle of January, that there start to be the kinds of protests, which I'm going to talk about what should come before it, but by the middle of January, you are starting to see protests in cities that have the character of people staying and not leaving. There'll be some protests that'll simply be candlelight vigils every night. There'll be other protests that will be different kinds of manifestations, schools, hospitals, workplaces. But there has to be a situation where it's starting to be on the agenda that thousands of people are gathering and refusing to leave till this regime is driven from power. Then by MLK weekend, which is the weekend of the 14th and 16th, at that's the point we are advocating that millions of people need to start coming into Washington, D.C. and cities across the country and refusing to leave and building up their power so that by the time that there's a scheduled inauguration, there are voices in the powers that be that say, wait a second, that they see a political crisis looming that is such that they find another solution to this and render this actually illegal or illegitimate, whatever they come up with. But people should be thinking about things like some of the actions that happened around Black Lives Matter and Occupy, but even more what's just transpired, you know, not the substance of it in South Korea or Tahrir Square or movements in other countries at other times when people have taken in their millions and millions to the streets and refused to leave until there was a change. We can't, look, PZ just made this point. We can't, any reliance on the established political process. Obama has told you that we should wish him success, that it was an intramural skirmish. We're all on the same team. Bernie Sanders says we should work with him where we can work with him. No, you actually have to stop this. And so people have to recognize that you can't go at this from within the established political process, but you have to basically work outside of it and in many ways against that process right now to be able to force a change. Mm-hmm. So that's the basic thrust of the plan. Now, to start, I mean, I don't mean to monopolize the conversation, but what we've been talking about here is this meeting in New York replicated around the country, followed by we want to have a letter that goes out, and people are working on this, and clergy or religious forces are working on a letter so that first day of Hanukkah, Christmas, and those of us who are atheists will find our communities, but on that holiday spirit to be have people act consistent with their values to refuse this regime. Then New Year's Eve, there should be demonstrations everywhere that the news that year is this is not a year to celebrate, but a year of struggle to stop this. And then the following week, we're hoping that there could be political protests around a variety of the issues encompassed by this regime and people around different topics and things like that. Big push on the campuses that are open. And then on MLK weekend, there should be a lot of protests specifically targeting what he's planning to do around black people in particular, but also other minorities, national minorities, and maybe soon to be majorities, but the oppression of different peoples and stuff. Then culminating in this last week of refusing to leave. That's in broad sketches. We are still just starting our conversation, even among those of us who initiated, about all the specifics of the plans. We need a lot more people throwing in on this right now, and we're not intending to organize everything ourselves. Far from it. We're actually putting forward a vision and asking every organization, every group, every individual to get out there and act in a way that will actually stop this.
Mm-hmm. And I see that, too, that what we've got to do is get existing organizations to sign on and work with us. So, like, for instance, one sign that I find hopeful is that there's an organization called Defend Science, which formed under the George W. Bush regime, because, as you may recall, Bush was pretty horrible on science, and he was proposing all kinds of nonsense and limiting science and just being, you know, anti-science in general. And now Defend Science has stepped forward and said that they also support this month of resistance. So getting organizations like that where we have special interests to sign on and say, yeah, we agree that, for instance, this guy is going to be terribly anti-science, and so for our own personal self-interest, we have to fight back. We can build a movement that's got many building blocks that are working together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's extreme. Go ahead.
Michael, can I just cut in there?
Yeah, sure.
I just think this question of science is very, very, very important right now. We have, you know, just trying to get a list here of the initiators. Even our first list includes not only P.Z. Myers, but Niles Eldridge. It includes Michael A. Wood, Jr. You know, these are the three of them are all very established scientists, and there's been very important protests by scientists. And yes, there's the self-interest of the science, but a society that isn't based on the truth and objective reality and on science is a society that's headed for a cataclysm, especially in this era of global warming, not to mention the reproductive and basic rights of women in society. This is a person who, you know, who wants to criminalize abortion. This is a person who says the jury is out, essentially, on whether or not humans have anything to do with, or even whether there is global warming. This is serious stuff, that the fate of all of humanity hangs in the balance. And maybe PZ could just say something about the importance of that. I mean, he writes about this all the time on his blog, the importance of actual truth and scientific method. This is at stake. This is
absolutely.
One of the things many of the climate scientists are terrified about is, you know, he's appointed a climate science denier to head everything. And scientists have started putting out these calls, you know, we need to back up all our data quickly before Trump comes in and has it erased or sequestered or lost to us. And that's remarkable. I have never heard that sort of thing from any scientist until this moment, when suddenly we're feeling that not only is our support for science in question, but the actual data we've generated is in peril.
Boy. You know,
also, scientists in the government, hasn't there been a refusal among people doing work on climate change to refuse to turn over their names?
That's already
been demanded by an administration that's not in power.
Yeah, was that the technical workers that refused to do that?
You know what? I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I thought it was people who might have worked on the Paris Accords or various.
That was part of it. Yeah, but there was another grouping of people that refused to actually take part in what the Trump regime was actually insisting that they do. You know, one of the things I wanted to say though is I just have to say, this situation that we're living in right now is unprecedented in a certain sense in this country, where you're standing on this precipice like this, and where there's like the kinds of broad sentiment in society. There's also a lot of people trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And then there's this huge broad sentiment, or this huge sentiment of this fascist, you know, these fascist hangers on and, you know, stalwarts and all this stuff. And that this thing that's shaping up in the midst of this, what has been proposed here and what is taking shape, what is going to take shape with this campaign is itself entirely unprecedented on a whole lot of levels, and I think is extremely important for people to get. This is a chance where we actually have an opportunity to stand up and change the course of history in a way that has an impact. It's not just a saying to say that in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. That's actually what it is, and that's something people really have to get in terms of seeing what's going on and how, and figuring out how are they going to take part in this, how are they going to be part of this and not be standing on the sidelines.
Well, you're right, Michael. I think people look. There's 5 weeks to this inauguration. There are many schools are closed during this period. I think it's time for students and the professors and others of us who influence students to say, change your plans for winter break and throw everything, throw your whole soul and heart and mind into fighting this now. Don't wait to see. I think we have to talk to people who are of that 60s generation who maybe are not quite as tied down with work as before. Donate the next 5 weeks to doing everything you can to activating your community, to writing about it. Come to New York and staff the national office or form offices in your own town. This is a time when we should have a vision of what it would be if there were hundreds of thousands and then millions of people in the streets where and in the public square with and not leaving, where every night a new 200, 300,000 people came out with candles, some with marches, some with even more determination. And every city was beginning to be, this is what was happening. If you remember, right after the non-indictment of the policeman in Ferguson, Missouri, and then of here in New York when Eric Garner was choked to death, the nights afterwards, there was between 5 and 10,000 people marching almost every night in different cities. Take that and multiply it by 10 and then 100. And not just the kinds of young people who want to run through the streets, which is very important. We need that. But also people who just want to go out and stand and say, I will not be moved. I will not be moved. I'm going to stand on the water, as Bob Dylan said, to stand on the ocean and a hard rain's going to fall. We need this kind of thing where imagine millions of people doing this and then tens of millions and what kind of crisis that would create. And that's what we're talking about. And it can't just be a symbolic demonstration on inaugural day. I'm sorry, that's part of it. But if it isn't something where people have said, we will not live under this, that's the vision here. And it's unprecedented in many ways in this country, but it is not impossible. The sentiment is there. The people are there. There's a basic vision and plan. So then people have to get organized and get busy and do it.
Mm-hmm. All it takes is will, and that's what we need now is for people to do this. I mean, this is my holiday, right? I'm supposed to be taking it easy with my family in these coming weeks, and that was my plan until last week when I talked to Sansara Taylor. And now all of a sudden I'm flying to New York this weekend. And, you know, that's because I am terrified and I don't want to someday talk to my grandchildren who ask me, what did I do when this happened? And say, well, I didn't do anything. It's time to fight back.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. Very good. I want to thank you guys both for joining us today. And once again, can you give the rundown of what's actually going to happen right now?
Yes. Okay. So on Monday, the 19th, at Cooper Union in New York, it's just been announced there's going to be an emergency mass organizing meeting to stop the Trump regime before it starts, you know, to prevent the Trump-Pence regime from taking power before it starts. It's important to point out it's prevent Trump and Pence. And we're just forming a speakers list, but it will include Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and an initiator of Refused Fascism, and he and Cornel West started the Mass Incarceration Network. It will involve Immortal Technique, who's a hip-hop artist and urban activist focused on global politics. P.Z. Myers will be there, and he's been announced. He's at the University of Minnesota, Morris. Jeremy Scahill, who is the founding senior editor of The Intercept, and he's the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and he's done some very important work on Pence and the connections to Prince, who's the head of Blackwater, such as it was. I will be, I believe, moderating this. And there are other people that we are collecting names of and people who will be part of this. But most of all, we need lots and lots of people there who want to become organizers of the organizers, who then themselves become organizers. It will be live streamed from refusefascism.org, and I believe also we're working with to have it live streamed on Huffington Post and possibly Deep Dish. These are all things in process right now. So people will be able to watch it all over the country. And then right after this, there will be similar programs in different cities and towns across the country. And so it has to be a movement that is mushrooming day by day throughout the holidays. People should right away get this call, go to the website, sign the call, donate money so we can publish it as a full-page ad in the New York Times and on all kinds of websites over the next weeks. Hold meetings with your family, salons, raise funds, get your friends, get the people at your workplace to do things. There's lots to do. The arts, there should be shutdowns of shows and new shows. And, you know, I say shutdowns of shows, I mean, maybe a silent moment that shows or people coming out on the stage and saying that they are going to be doing this in January. So it's just, there's plenty for people to do. And we want to let the imagination of millions of people get involved in this with a determination to stop it. As TZ said before, let it not be said that you did nothing when you had a chance to do something to stop what could be a real horror for humanity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy, PZ, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, okay. Thank you. And PZ, I'll see you on Monday in New York.
Yes, you will. I'll stop by Revolution Books.
All right, that's good. All right.
Okay.
All right, talk to you guys later. Take
okay,
care.
Okay, great. Thanks
bye
a lot.
Bye-bye. Bye. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with PZ Myers, biologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota Morris and author of the blog Pharyngula, and Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City. We've been talking about Refuse Fascism, to stop the fascist Trump-Pence regime before it starts. Again, this was pre-recorded, and obviously the December 19th event is already passed, but you can check out the video at refusefascism.org. Once again, that's refusefascism.org. And you can find events and organizations in your area and how to start organizing if there aren't any. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Sonia Kennebec, director and producer of the film National Bird. So stay tuned.
We're told that after the war, the Nazis vanished without a trace. But battalions of fascists still dream of a master race. The history books, they tell of their defeat in 45. But they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. They say the prisoner of Spandau was a symbol of defeat. Whilst Hess remained in prison, then the fascists, they were beat. So the promise of an Aryan world would never materialise. So why did they all come out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died? The world is riddled with maggots, the maggots are getting fat. They're making a tasty meal of all the bosses and bureaucrats. They're taking over the boardrooms and they're fat and full of pride. And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. So if you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies.
That was Chumbawamba with one of my favorite songs these days, The Day the Nazi Died. And now let's start our conversation with Sonia Kennebec. I recently had the opportunity to see a film called National Bird. And it was a film that just really, I didn't expect it to be what it was. And I was very, very moved by it. And particularly in relation to the film appearing in relation to what's going on in this country and in the world today. We have the election of an open fascist and we have the world actually just in total turmoil. And here's a person who's actually basically talking about he's going to run over the world and whatever it takes, whatever it is, he's going to make America great again. And as listeners to this show know, we've always believed that America was never great. And I wanted to talk with the person who directed this film. Her name is Sonia Kennebec. The name of the film is National Bird. Sonia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah. Well, as you can see, I'm not holding back any punches on this one. I loved your film, and I think it's extremely important for the times today. Give people a synopsis of the film.
This is a film about the U.S. drone war and National Bird, but told not by some experts, people in suits in front of a bookshelf, but it directly told by the people who are most impacted by the drone war. So the people who work worked within the drone program, the veterans, and then the people also in the target countries who are affected by drones.
Mm-hmm. Now, what compelled you to do this film?
I was really just curious to learn more about the program. It is a secret program, and all of the people who I interviewed, the veterans, had top secret clearances. And they all worked within this secret program. So when they decided to speak out about this program, they became whistleblowers, which means whistleblowing means to expose waste, fraud, abuse, crimes, illegal activity. So they really wanted to speak about a program that they thought the public doesn't know enough about.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that's really, I mean, it's very heavy because when you talk about that, when you're saying that you went to these people and they agreed to do this, you know, this is, as you're saying, and as we'll get into later in the interview, this is a very heavy move for them. I mean, it's something that really could bring down just consequences that they might not have even thought about. How did their willingness to actually be in the film come about? What drove them to actually say, yes, I want to be in this film? Because they seem to have come at it from different directions, but they all have, there's sort of a through line that's running through all of them. What was it? What made them want to do this film?
Yeah, you're right. It was a very risky project for all of us, for the whistleblowers on the film, also for myself and my team. And we discussed the risks very openly. So early on, I started talking to lawyers, to a First Amendment lawyer. I contacted a whistleblower lawyer to represent the people in my film, my interview partners, my lead characters. And yes, and we tried to, make it as safe as possible, but there were repercussions. And it is not a good time, to be a whistleblower in the U.S. And I think the reason, though, that all of the whistleblowers in my film decided to speak out and be so courageous is that they felt this very, very strong need that the public has to understand what is going on, how these wars, how the drone war is being fought in their name. So they're all patriots, from my perspective. They all voluntarily entered the military and the Air Force, but they saw something in it, and that's what they talk about the film, that, made them really take on the risk and be public about it and talk about a secret program and take on this risk. And I really think it's what they experience, what changed them. And as you said, there are, different reasons for all of them. So, one of my lead characters, Heather, she lost at least three of her fellow airmen, friends of hers to suicide. She herself was on a suicide watch list while she was in the program, so she's struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder. Another one of my, lead characters who had a long career in the military, her last deployment was the drone program. And what she saw, the way the program was working, the number of people who became targets, all of what she saw within this program, she thought was wrong. And it was very important to bring transparency to it, to let the people know how the program works, how people are being targeted, and also to discuss that this drone war can also come back to us.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's also another character in the film, another whistleblower, Daniel. And what about him? Because I thought he was also very interesting. He was someone who seemed to approach this. He seemed to approach this first and foremost from a sort of, well, I wasn't really, he doesn't approach it from, oh, what I did, but he's actually like, this was outrageous. This was something that goes against, this was a crime against humanity, basically. And he seems to have taken a stand on that level, which I thought was very important.
Yes, I think all of the characters in my film, see it from a very humanitarian perspective. But Daniel in particular, he speaks about his work in a Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, which was also this military network that, killed Osama bin Laden. So he enlisted for the Air Force, but he ended up in this program, and he was involved in going after high-value targets. And many of the things that he saw when he was in the program, he really thought were not right, especially, one of the things he's talking about is that when you go after a high-value target, you go after one person and one person only. And what is happening within the drone program is that this high-value target is with a group of people. These people are just seen as collateral damage. And that's one of the things that he is talking about in the film.
You know, one of the things that really got me too is that you look at this and exactly the picture that you're just painting. And when you're looking at the graphics in the film and you're seeing the what supposedly people see or what people do see when you're running one of these drones and you're actually operating the thing and you see this thing and you're looking at these stick figures almost, these tiny little stick figures on the ground. But you can discern even that these are, that, well, these might be children, these might be this might be that. And it was just sort of, you're watching this and you're looking and you're seeing that it actually, it's hard to think about this because it's actually, it dehumanizes people without actually coming out and saying, well, you know, the hell with it. These aren't human beings anyway. But it just reduces people to, on one level, it reduces people to these stick figures that it's very easy to say, well, who can tell? Yeah, it might be, might not. Just wipe it out and you erase the stick figures from the picture. But at the same time, people know, like, you know, the people in the witnesses in your film know that those stick figures, each one of them represents a human. And it's a very different stance that they take versus the people that you have in the background there talking about, well, is that a kid? Well, maybe it's a kid, who knows? And it's a very powerful contrast there.
Yes, and that's what I really wanted to do with the film. I wanted to bring humanity back into the drone program, because when people hear about drones, they think about the technology and these unmanned, armed airplanes, but they don't think about the people who are actually operating those drones, but also the people who are in the target countries who are impacted by this war. And it's easy to disregard, as you said, that there are actually real people, human beings impacted when you just see a black and white image. It's very grainy, and you know, you don't see the humanity behind it. And we've seen, you know, the film is currently in theaters, and you know, we do see, you know, a very strong reaction of some people who you know, after the screening, who come out and tell us, oh, I didn't even think about, you know, the other side or the people who are operating the drones. The film does exactly that. It brings the humanity back, and that to many people is shocking.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with film director Sonia Kennebec, and she's the director of the film National Bird, a scathing exposure of what U.S. imperialism's drone program does to people around the world, including some people who were actually involved in the drone program coming forward to testify about the horrors that were unleashed by the U.S. using these drones on the world. You know what I really like about the film, too, though, is that in a way, it doesn't really, you don't show, you know, what I really like about it is I think that there's actually an element here where you present the witnesses to this, the people that were actually operating the drones, you present that, but you don't say, oh, pity them, because they themselves aren't asking for that kind of, like, understand what we were, but they're actually saying, look, doing this actually changed me as a human being, changed me as a person. I was doing things that I find reprehensible, you know, and that to me was very heavy, because you could ask people all along and say to people, well, you know, look, let's just go along. You went along with the program, blah, 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 whatever, and it wasn't your fault. But actually, these people, one of the things that marks the people in this film is that they take responsibility for what was done. And that's very, very heavy. And it seemed that that was something that motivated them coming out and speaking up around this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of guilt as well of being part of this program, part of this weapon. And I think where some of the trauma comes from, at least, you know, my characters, my interview partners have told me that, is that they are operating the drones from complete safety. Most of the people who work in the drone program are based in the U.S. So when they are fighting this war in this secret environment, they are not in immediate danger or in any danger themselves. And that's one thing that has really changed with this new technology, is that you can kill a lot of people from a very far distance without endangering yourself. And the schizophrenic thing about, you know, this type of warfare for the people who are fighting this war is too that they are doing their 12-hour shift, fighting a war abroad, and then when the shift is over, they leave the base, they go, you know, to Walmart or to a Starbucks, go back to their families and their kids. But they cannot talk about their experiences because they had, you know, top secret clearances. Often the psychologists, psychiatrists don't have these types of clearances, so they can't even talk to, you know, a medical professional about their experiences. And so that's a big part of their struggle, that they have to keep it to themselves. and they can't process anything, and they're also not in immediate danger. And then, of course, you know, it's the sloppiness, the messiness, all of that that they talk about in the film.
Mm-hmm. And not to mention that they seem to be really horrified by the fact that they're relentlessly taking people's lives, you know, which is like, yikes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, some people in the drone program, you know, participate in killing more people than most people who are, most soldiers who are in direct combat. We've seen some numbers that are just very, very shocking.
I was going to say, one of the people I want to talk about in particular is Lisa, and she talks about having learned that in her time operating a drone, that there were 121,000 people that died because of that?
Well, we don't know if they died. So she received a commendation medal from the Air Force for her work on the gigantic surveillance system, which is also classified a weapon system that works with the drone. So what I tried to explain in the film, it's not just the drone itself that is this weapon, but also the system, it's called DGS, that's behind the drones. It's a gigantic, enormous surveillance system that's global, and it just really sucks up all of this data from people. And so when she, you know, finished her military service, she received a medal, and that said that she worked on a system that identified 121,000 insurgent targets during Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, so in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that was only within a two-year period. So there's no way, really, of knowing, at least, you know, Lisa, my lead character, doesn't know how many of, you know, what really happened to these insurgent targets. But the number itself, I think, is incredible. It's enormous.
One thing that comes across with Lisa, too, Lisa's the character you're just talking about, her story is so compelling because she, of all of them, and I'm not sort of gradating which one did the heaviest things, but she actually felt compelled to go to Afghanistan and to actually talk to, or at least be present while people were spoken to about their feelings. And I thought that was something you did that was very important with the film, is you didn't limit yourself to just the people who were operating the drones or anything else. You actually went out and you spoke to people who had been victims of these drone attacks, and that is extremely important. Can you give people a little sense of what that was like?
Yeah, that is the most emotional part, I think, in the film. That's what a lot of our audience members say. And it was actually very emotional for us as well to film it, to go over to Afghanistan. And besides the risk of, you know, traveling into a war zone, which Lisa did, and my director of photography, Torsten Lapp, and I did it also. It was talking to these victims and survivors who were so honest and open about their experiences. And one of the things that is particularly moving, I think, is that none of the people who we spoke to in Afghanistan has anger. There's actually so much forgiveness and just peacefulness about them. And I think that is what moves people the most in the U.S. when they watch it, because they see these people who have been maimed. They're all civilians, and this is actually a strike that the Air Force and the U.S. military actually investigated themselves. So these were all, it's proven, these were all civilians, but they lost 23 family members, including children, these family members who I spoke to. But when they are talking to us, they really just want to inform the world community about what has happened to them, and they're asking the U.S. to stop.
You know, although I have to say, the people there have every right in the world to be angry as hell about what's going on, and I think that actually we need a little bit more anger in the world today in terms of what's going on, you know? So, no, I'm serious.
But didn't you find it yourself so incredibly, really moving that, yes, you know, I went over there as well expecting anger, and there was no trace of that. And the people really said to us that, you know, this is what has happened to us, and we want to tell our stories. And they are, you know, they are telling us about their dreams and their hopes and their lives. But their conclusion is not driven by anger, but it's really more about forgivefulness, I think.
Well, yeah, but I'll tell you again, I understand where they're coming from, but I also think, you know, here's a point for us, for us watching this film, I think we better get angry about what's going on, because what America is doing, what this country is doing to people all over the world, really needs to, it warrants tremendous anger. And when you see these people who are, yes, talking about, and look, they're very heartbroken. They're talking about their daughters, their baby daughters, their, you know, little kids. They're talking about what happened. They're showing that they don't have any legs left or anything like that. And they're talking about their life has been completely changed. And they're saying, but don't do this. And they're questioning, why do you have to do this? Don't do it. Why do you have to do it? Don't do it. And I think for everybody who's watching that film, we better come out of that with some sense of anger about what the U.S. is doing around the world, or there's big problems. There's really big problems.
And I think the big danger is with this weapon that it's so easy to use. You're not putting boots on the ground. You're not losing, you know, political capital. You know, these weapons can basically fly anywhere in the world and be flown by people who are in complete safety in the U.S., so it makes it incredibly easy to use. And what people, you know, often, you know, tell us, what they didn't understand before watching this film, is that it's not as surgical and precise as the politicians tell us, because what the drones are doing is they're dropping bombs. They're dropping, you know, and, you know, firing hellfire missiles. They're dropping big bombs and bombing buildings. And do you really know who's inside a building when you're bombing a building? There's a public narrative, and then there's a reality. And what I try to do with this film is to show the reality.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that's very important, including, you know, I was going to say, look, there's a lot of reports that have come out over the past, and I think your film will fit in nicely with those reports, including these reports that actually do show, you know, what the savagery that the U.S. has unleashed on the people in Afghanistan, the people in Pakistan, the idea that in some places where they will see a big party of people, a wedding party or something, and they'll go in and they'll bomb it, and then all of a sudden they don't withdraw. The drone doesn't. It withdraws just a little bit, but it withdraws just enough to, for the people, the relatives, the loved ones to come out and try to gather up the pieces of their loved ones who have just been slaughtered. And then they come back and open up on the people who are trying to save their or bring back their loved ones after the people who've been killed. So this is a savage business that the U.S. has unleashed over there. And I want to thank you very much for making your film. And I really encourage people to go and see it. So thank you very much. Okay, Sonia?
Thank you so much. Sure. This is, you know, your feedback is really wonderful. I really appreciate it.
All right. And I appreciate what you've done. So take care, and we'll talk with you again soon sometime, okay?
Okay. Thank you
okay,
so much.
Sure. All right. Take care now. Bye. All right. That was Sonia Kennebec, director and producer of the film National Bird. And if you'd like to know more about the film, including finding a screening in your area, go to nationalbirdfilm.com. Once again, that's nationalbirdfilm.com. Also, if you want to be part of Stopping the Fascist Trump, go to refusefascism.org. Once again, that's refusefascism.org. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my guests for today, Andy Z, P.Z. Myers, and Sonia Kennebec. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Kiana Williams. And I'd also like to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a song that is an old favorite of mine. It's Jennifer Warren's covering First We Take Manhattan, Then We Take Berlin.
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom, but trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take men.